Royal Society and people like Pettine and the collaborations that they're doing to form this very powerful nexus, which is going to go on to inform all the later developments of economics and all the later developments of social sciences. And it's going to definitely continue well into the 19th century. And it's going to continue to invoke all these Baconian kind of arguments about induction versus deduction. And really, it's, this is the epicenter of everything. And that's what we mean when we say political economy kind of stems from here or is rises from here. It doesn't mean that someone wrote on a piece of paper, "I invented political economy." That's not the real argument. The argument is that there's a confluence of all these different elements, which forms a potent mixture out of which all these different streams spring out and go in all these different directions and proliferate and form all these new sciences and these new ideas and directions. So that's really what I find really interesting. I could keep going forever about this. It's super fascinating. But to round it all off, basically what ends up happening through all this is that the real reason that the Glorious Revolution happens is over the Bank of England, the formation of the Bank of England. And it has to go back to these ideas of James Harrington about land and ideas that a lot of people, like I was just mentioning, someone like Locke is concerned with, is where does value come in? Where is value stored? Is value a property of land or metal or labor? Is it just subjective? What's the idea there? And this is to go back to what I was saying way before, I think at the previous part of this episode, is that we're dealing with the fictionalization of the economy, right? And this is exactly where the economy is fictionalized in the formation of the Bank of England in 1695, because this is where the speculative paper economy is formed. The reason that that ends up happening is because basically, James II, Charles II, and James II, they are proponents of a scarcity theory of value. They believe that there's a limited amount of wealth, a limited amount of resources, and they believe that wealth is endowed and an objective property of land and resources, and they believe that there's a limited amount of it, and that, you know, life is defined by competition over this scarce value and these resources, and that there's not enough to go around. And so what they end up advocating for is, first of all, a monopoly that they give, you know, a monopoly that Charles II and James II give to the East India Company to have total control over the trade in Asia, which makes all the independent merchants in England very unhappy. They want to get in on that. But by the prevailing theory that the Stuarts are using during this time, is that they have to have this monopoly on trade. Otherwise, it would spiral out of control. The competition, the pie is only so big, right? It's not big enough for all these English merchants to cut into and take little pieces of. They want to consolidate everything and have one monopolistic trader to maximize the amount that they get out of Asia. And what the Whigs end up forming around is the idea of infinite credit and infinite wealth. Is they believe, basically, in the Bank of England totally fictionalizing the economy and turning it into a speculative paper economy and just circulating credit around infinitely inside of the economy. They don't believe that the value is in the money, in the gold or anything. That's why it goes, you know, they propose going to paper, is because they believe the value comes about in the changing of hands of that credit and that money. And just by passing it around through the economy, it will create infinite growth, right? They believe literally that, you know, the economic potential for growth is limitless in that respect. So that's the key divide that ends up influencing the Glorious Revolution, is that the James II, you know, not that his Catholicism didn't matter, it certainly did, but James II is certainly a proponent of a economic theory that was not conducive to what all of the, you know, prevailing merchants and most of the people in England wanted to do. Is everyone was against him. That's really where the coalition came in, and they all funded William III to come over and boot him out because they wanted that infinite credit. And everyone kind of agreed, even Locke for his part. I mean, even though he had problems with this theory of value that was being proposed, he still wanted a Bank of England. Everyone wanted the Bank of England, and everyone wanted all this free credit and all this money. They thought it would be, you know, obviously very good for the growth of the nation. And it clearly was, because look what happened. But this really goes back into the source of everything. And William Petty and his work was very intimately connected in spreading some of those ideas, like his ideas of velocity of money, for example, even though Petty, for his part, sided with the Stuarts in this, and that he rooted the value of things in land, and just like James Harrington did. That's why James Harrington wanted his spiritual aristocracy to have all this land, is that that's where the actual value was. That's what they saw. But, you know, those ideas got passed by the wayside. So in that sense, you know, they're the precursors of Marx, and that the founders of political economy going back to the 17th century are, you know, Marxists, proto-Marxists, at least in their theories of value, even though, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think that that would be the case at all, would it?
Paintings often show treasures, but paintings have become treasures themselves. Art galleries are like palaces, but they are also like banks. When they shut for the night, they are guarded, lest the images of the things which are desirable are stolen. The value of paintings has become mysterious. Where, we ask ourselves, does this value come from? This picture, which shows a 17th century patron surrounded by his collection, tells us more about Europe and painting from the Renaissance onwards than hundreds of art books or essays on aesthetics. What does it show? The sort of man for whom painters painted their paintings. What are these paintings? Before they're anything else, they are objects which can be bought and owned. Unique objects. Patron cannot be surrounded by music or poems in the same way as he is surrounded by his pictures. From about 1500 to 1900, the visual arts of Europe were dominated by the oil painting. This kind of painting had never been used anywhere else in the world before. The tradition of oil painting was made up of hundreds of thousands of unremarkable works, hung all over the walls of galleries and private houses, rather in the same way as the reserve collection is still hung in the National Gallery. European oil painting, unlike the art of other civilizations and periods, placed a unique emphasis on the tangibility, the solidity, texture, the weight, the graspability of what was depicted. What was real was what you could put your hands on, as we are normally taught to do. We emphasize the genius of the few and concentrate only on the exceptional works. We will misunderstand what the tradition was really about.
The continuing adventures of Admiral Edman. Brought to you by the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Admiral Ed Byrd, once again. At the dawn of the fourth day, we have made landfall on Robinson Crusoe's island. The fog has not abated, only intensified. We are truly within the misty veil. One could almost make out figures when the wind blows, or little tricks of the mind revealed upon inspection to be merely cloud. The superstitious chatter only grows. Several of the crew spotted, rising up on the beach, some kind of infernal idol, a monstrous totem, beckoning all to come towards it with open arms. Scattered about its feet were what appeared to be offerings. They looked to be coins of Spanish gold.
I thought it would be cool to mention something analogous to the machinery question that took place not in Great Britain, but in America. I'm actually kind of reluctant to call this an iteration of the machinery question proper, since Ricardo's writings and the subsequent Mechanics Institute movement actually took place after this, and much later date. But it's a particularly fascinating little strand that connects what would later be called the American School of Economics, which was based on protectionism, internal improvements, and the stimulation of infant industries through things like subsidies, and connects these up with a preoccupation with the machine. And much of what I'm going to talk about right here comes from this very interesting book by a guy named Leo Marx, the other Marx maybe, titled The Machine in the Garden, Technology and the Pastoral Ideal in America. And the object of Leo's analysis here is the reception of technology across American history, with technology existing both in tension with, but also folded into a very idiosyncratic understanding of nature. And here our friend Leo tracks this sense of nature that grew on the continent, beginning in the pre-revolutionary era, back to an Elizabethan vision of the pastoral as a new Eden. He quotes from Beverly's 1705 History and Present State of Virginia as one of his many examples to draw this out. And so he uses quite a few quotes from this work, but this is one that I thought was really nice. The country was so delightful and desirable, so pleasant and plentiful, the climate and the air so temperate, sweet, and wholesome, the woods and the soil so charming and fruitful, and all other things so agreeable, the paradise itself seemed to be there in the first native luster. All the countries, seated in or near the latitude of Virginia, are esteemed the fullest and pleasantest of all climates. These are reckoned the gardens of the world. It's a strikingly utopian image. The garden of the world, says Leo, is pulled from the language of myth. The garden here, it has something of a, might call like a double function. On the one hand, it signals the mythic primal unity of the world, but at the same time, Beverly was also speaking of the physical gardens that were being constructed to sustain the livelihoods of the settlers. So you kind of have that implexing already of human industriousness, the transformation of nature being in a way synonymous with nature itself. This is a kind of another take on the natural law tradition, but it's almost as if human industriousness here in the new world, you know, in America, in the new Atlantis, is regenerating kind of a primal mythic unity that perhaps had been shattered in some way. This is a movement of redemption, almost. But let's leap forward just a bit to the period immediately following the American Revolution and meet Tench Cox. He's a 30-year-old-something merchant from Philadelphia. And between 1786 and 1787, Cox was traveling about all over the former colonies. He was giving a series of talks. He was at the Annapolis meeting on commercial regulations that led to the call for a constitutional convention. And he was also meeting with the Society for Political Inquiries, and also was affiliated with something called the Pennsylvania Society for the Encouragement of the Manufacturers and Useful Arts. And there are several key themes that moved through all these talks and different things that Cox was up to. And one of them was the encouragement of domestic manufacturers as a means of achieving a balanced economy. But the problem that Cox was confronting was a generalized scarcity of labor that existed in nascent America. And this is a situation that was completely in contrast with industrialized Britain, where there was great supply of labor. You had a century earlier, like Petty, talking about the need to import more and more people into Great Britain in order to continually raise productivity of labor, to increase the great masses of wealth. And then you had later Malthus taking something of an opposite position, where the overproduction of the population, in a way, I guess, was nothing short of a potentially apocalyptic scenario. But in early America, we didn't have this great supply of labor. We instead had a generalized scarcity of labor. That's Cox's first theme that he's kind of honing in upon. But the second theme that he prioritized takes us back to this garden image of Beverly, you know, the natural abundance of the American landscape. And Cox thinks that this abundance, you know, will solve this problem of labor scarcity. It doesn't matter how scarce labor is, because America's abundance will just directly flow into the rising productivity of labor with the proper application of machinery. And in Cox's understanding, the machinery, machines, find their destiny in America. Because this is the first time that the true surpluses of natural resources appropriate to these mechanical instruments is truly found. The line promoted by Cox goes, you know, that America will ultimately avoid the path that was Britain was on. This is the very path that generated the machinery question in the first place, the great displacement of people by machinery. America will not suffer this kind of fate because it's in America, you know, this this new Eden, where the machine will first truly be applied. And here's a good quote from Cox. He says, "Unless business of this kind," and this business is the cultivation of manufacturing and the mechanical arts, says, "a certain great natural powers of this country will remain inactive and useless." So what he's saying here is that the very hyperabundancy of the American garden is, in a quite literal sense, crying out to be transformed through industrial processes. It's, you know, what is the point of this this Eden, this great abundance of water and land and trees and soil? You know, what's the point of it if it can't be inserted into the industrial machinery? And here's another quote from Cox that I thought was really quite good. He says, "Providence has bestowed upon the United States of America means of happiness as great and numerous as are enjoyed by any country in the world. A soil fruitful and diversified, a healthy climate, mighty rivers and adjacent seas abounding with fish are the great advantages for which we are indebted to a beneficial creator. Agriculture, manufactures, and commerce, naturally arising from these sources, afford to our industrious citizens certain sustenance and innumerable opportunities of acquiring wealth." So it sort of draws out the relationship between industriousness here and this sense of nature in America, which is linked directly to Providence itself. And the Pennsylvania Manufacturing Society that Cox was associated with did a lot of work to promote these sorts of ideas. Like, during the July 4th celebrations of 1788, they participated in a federal procession in Philadelphia, and they had a 30-foot-long float. And on the float, there were workers who demonstrated how various new technologies, the spinning jenny, carding machines, and looms, they demonstrated how these would work. And above this float was draped a flag bearing the motto, "May the Union Government Protect the Manufacturers of America." And what makes this so interesting is that by this point, Cox was serving as the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, and he was serving directly under Alexander Hamilton. So when Hamilton began the work that would emerge in the 1791 report on the subject of manufacturers, this is the report that laid out the details of what would later be the American School of Economics, Cox was deeply involved. He provided most of the statistical data that Hamilton utilized. The importance of stimulating industry that Cox had earlier displayed, you know, this was completely center stage in the Hamiltonian perspective. But what the report ultimately lacked was that kind of poetical, naturalistic vision that Cox's earlier work had privileged. And just because it's not very well known at all, I'd like to mention Thoughts on Political Economy, published by a character named Daniel Raymond in 1820. It's a very strange work. It's an early example of American political economy that used Hamilton's report on the subject of manufacturers as its leaping off point. And so the argument that Raymond stages is that the report is the closest America had come to having a domestic work of political economy. But because Hamilton wasn't interested in political economy so much, the report's contents were never really properly systematized. And this is what Raymond was setting out to do. And on the way, he affirms all the elements of what later be called a national system. And this would be protectionism, internal improvements, all stuff of that nature. He builds this out from a critique of Adam Smith, who he considered as having like hopelessly muddled understanding of national wealth. This is because Smith considered wealth in terms of the output of production in masses of capital. But for Raymond, wealth was in productivity itself. The more productive the nation is, the more wealthy it is. And in order to achieve this ultra-productive state, he went much further in advocating government intervention into the market than pretty much anyone else in his time. He deprivileged the large-scale private company, and he thought that public companies were beneficial to private companies as long as they were very tightly regulated. And of course, financial speculation and other non-productive endeavors were to be discouraged. And Raymond presents an interesting problem at this point, because if wealth is in productivity itself, then what are we to make of the output of production? And so he ends up tossing aside the whole question of productive versus unproductive labor. This is something that you find in the line running from Adam Smith down through Marx. And he instead focused on what kind of labor is conducive to a moral life. And most treatments of Raymond, which there's only just a small handful, pretty much all of them highlight how this dimension of his political economy taps into the New England Puritanism that Raymond was brought up in. In Raymond's world, where to treat odes to self-interest and to economic self-cultivation and self-regulation with suspicion. Instead, we're supposed to begin from a perspective of the common good and recognition of fundamental human dignity. Paul Konkin, he has a book called Prophets of Prosperity, which is not that good, but it's interesting because he covers some generally unknown figures in American political economy. He suggests, and I think accurately, that Raymond was hoping to basically utilize Hamiltonianism as a means to achieve the religious utopian community on a national scale. So we could say here that Raymond had one foot in the utopian socialist religious currents that have so regretfully been wiped from the pages of American history, yet another foot in the concrete history of political economy. Because it wasn't simply from Hamilton and Carey that the German economist Friedrich List, who really formalized the idea of the national system in contrast to Smithian laissez-faire, these Hamilton and Carey weren't the only ones he was drawing from. He was also directly exposed to the writings of Raymond. And it was likely through Raymond's own constructive vision that he started to derive his own articulation of the national system.
Bankiers, Richtern, Henkern, Offizieren, Kirchenbossen, Politikern und ähnlichen Vertretern der Macht geduldet wird, der seine Rolle am Kreuz für euch weiter spielt und dem ihr aufs Maul schlagt, wenn er aus der Rolle fällt und der euch deshalb nicht zurufen kann, ich habe eure ganze Show und euer Ritual ersackt, euer Weihrauch ist mir ekelhaft, er stinkt nach verbranntem Menschenfleisch. Ich ertrage eure heiligen Feiern und Feste nicht länger. Ihr könnt so viel beten, wie ihr wollt, ich höre nicht hin. Behaltet eure idiotischen Ehren und Preisungen. Ich habe nichts damit zu schaffen. Ich will sie nicht. Ich bin auch keine Stütze von Ruhm und Sicherheit. Sicherheit, die ihr mit Tränengas erreicht und mit Gummiknüppeln. Ich bin auch keine Garantie für Gehorsam und Ordnung. Ordnung und Gehorsam von Besserungsanstalten, Gefängnissen, Zuchthäusern, Ehrenhäusern.
In order to legitimate demands before this new form, in connection with this practice, the Assembly of Estates became transformed into a modern parliament. a process that was, of course, drawn out over the entire century. Why conflicts that were thus fought out by involving the public arose so much earlier in Great Britain than in other countries is a problem not yet resolved. A literary public sphere existed on the continent, too, as an authority to which appeal could be made. There, however, it began to become politically significant only when, under the aegis of mercantilism, the capitalist mode of production had advanced to a stage reached in Great Britain after the Glorious Revolution. For in the second half of the 17th century, there emerged in Great Britain a large number of new companies engaged in and expanding the manufacture of textiles, the metal industry, and paper production. The traditional opposition between landed and moneyed interests, which in Great Britain had not in any event become entrenched as a pronounced conflict between classes, was now overlaid with a new conflict of interests between the restrictive interests of commercial and finance capital on one side and the expansive interests of manufacturing and industrial capital on the other. Awareness of this conflict began at the start of the 18th century. Only from this time on were commerce and trade no longer unquestionably synonymous with manufacture. To be sure, this conflict repeated an antagonism already typical of the earlier phases of capitalist development. The conflict between the interests of an older generation already established in the market and those of a younger generation was three events occurring in 1694 and 1695 marked the beginning of this development. The founding of the Bank of England, unlike that of the stock exchanges in Lyons and Amsterdam, signaled a new stage in the development of capitalism. On the basis of a capitalistically revolutionized mode of production, it promised the consolidation of a system until then held together by commerce. The elimination of the institution of censorship marked this new stage in the development of the public sphere. It made the influx of rational critical arguments into the press possible and allowed the latter to evolve into an instrument with whose aid political discussions could be brought before the new form of the public. Finally, the first cabinet government marked a new stage in the development of Parliament. It was the first step along a long path towards the parliamentization of state authority that led ultimately to the point at which the public active in the political realm established itself as an organ of the state. Already in the 1670s, the government had found itself compelled to issue proclamations that confronted the dangers bred by the coffeehouse discussions. The coffeehouses were considered seedbeds of political unrest. Censorship came to an end with the Licensing Act of 1695. The Queen several times admonished the members of Parliament to bring censorship back, but in vain. To be sure, the press continued to be subject to the strict law of libel and to the restrictions connected with numerous privileges of Crown and Parliament. The Stamp Act, enacted in 1712, resulted in a temporary setback. The journals printed fewer copies and were reduced in volume. Some disappeared altogether. Compared to the press in the other European states, however, the British press enjoyed unique liberties. Harley was the first statesman to understand how to turn the new situation to his advantage. He engaged authors like Defoe, who had been called the first professional journalist, who defended the cause of the Whigs not only in the pamphlets in use up until then, but also in the new journals. Indeed, he was the first to make the party spirit a public spirit. Defoe's Review and Swift's Examiner were discussed in clubs and coffee houses, at home and in the streets. Walpole and Bolingbroke themselves addressed the public. Men like Pope, Gay, Swift combined literature and politics in a peculiar fashion comparable to Addison's and Steele's combination of literature and journalism. In these first years, of course, the leading press was never in the hands of the opposition. The London Gazette for a long time, the only Gazette, in the old style of the political newspaper, discreetly limited the news reports. At the end of Queen Anne's rule, the Whigs, with the British Merchant, entered into competition against the Mercator, founded in 1713. Then, under George I, began the dominance of the Whigs that was to last for decades. But it was not the Whigs who, purchasing the London Journal in 1722, created a political journalism in the grand style. This was the work of the Tories, who now constituted themselves as the opposition under Bolingbroke. The innovation brought about by the opposition was the creation of a popular opinion. Bolingbroke and his friends knew how to form such a public opinion that
aimed at the same objective and furnished with like-minded impulses of will, could be mobilized for political use. This public opinion was directed by another factor, by the establishment of an independent journalism that knew how to assert itself against the government and the